There's a line from Shakespeare, many a slip betwixt cup and lip. And in general, people say to me all the time, you know, oh, you're micromanaging, you're sort of worried about all things that can go wrong. But the answer is the amount of stupidity that's out there never fails to surprise me.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to sages, gurus, and leaders and luminaries from all over the world to dispense wisdom for life and career in order to provide you shortcuts to excellence. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. Our guest today is Barry Nelbuff, who is a professor at the Yale School of Management. Barry has a 30-year career where he's been teaching negotiation, game theory, innovation, strategy. He's authored 6 books and an online course that I want to talk to you about, Barry. This online course is, first of all, welcome to the show, Barry.
Thank you.
This online course is on negotiation, and I want to mention it to the listeners. It's offered through Coursera, which is a site or an organization organized by 200 universities and big businesses. And they offer free online education. Your course on negotiation is really, really popular. There are over a quarter million active learners at any time. But you are the second highest ranked presenter, teacher in the group, and your score is 4.95 out of 5. So my first question is, Barry, one Yale guy.
Who's that person who didn't give me the 5? That's what I want to know. Who's that person?
Where's the 0.05? I mean, come on, where did you let yourself down with that?
Exactly. I'm a slacker.
My God, who's the top guy? Person. I mean, tough audience.
Well, I don't know, but 5.0 has to be the best. And so 4.95, that's the units they go with, is, you know, it hurts. What is it? We're number 2. Avis, we try harder. So there's always room for improvement on that.
That's a tough gig, man.
For a course of negotiation, I don't seem to have negotiated very well since I'm giving the course away. But there you have it. It's not all courses on Coursera are free. And in fact, they're actually slightly annoyed at me because I'm showing up some of the other courses they charge a lot more money for. But there you go.
There you go.
That's the
friend of the people. Now, the other thing I want to point out to listeners, Barry is not some sort of armchair academic. He has founded, participated in 2 or 3, I lose track, Barry, how many companies, 2 of which have been sold to major multinationals for some serious coin. So that's why when Barry speaks, we listen. And it's not an accident that, well, you mean you teach in the School of Management, so you know a bit about business. The point is, not only do you teach it, you do it, and you do it well. Now, speaking of money, that takes us into the very first lesson. It's actually more of a thought experiment. So you're asking us to do this, Barry. Imagine that we have 10 times more money than at present. The question is, what would you do differently?
I think this is the Harry Potter, the reverse mirror of desire, which is the mirror of Erised. The question is, how would you run your life differently if you had no constraints? And after we sold Honest Tea to Coca-Cola, I was in the fortunate position of being in that case where really the financial constraints of my life were lifted. And afterwards, I'm living in the same house, I'm working the same job, and married to the same woman. And what that says to me is that in some sense, I was doing things right beforehand because it wasn't as if there was something I fundamentally wanted to change in my life as a result of having more financial freedom. And that's an important lesson for people is to say, well, if you're doing what it is you really enjoy doing so that you don't have to change anything, that's a sign that you've got things right. Now, there's a flip to that same point, which is there were some things I did differently. For example, I hired a personal trainer and lost close to 40 pounds.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But I should have done that beforehand. It wasn't that expensive. And so there were some things, in some sense, I didn't do some things that I'm glad I didn't do, but the things that I did do differently, I should have done. And so another question you can ask is, what are the things that you would do if you had a whole lot more coin? And you may realize that some of them, there's no reason not to do right away.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping you.
There's nothing stopping. They weren't that expensive at the end of the day. And so go for it, is my view.
You mentioned that company, Honest Tea. And I think when we first met, I don't know if it had actually occurred yet, but I did read somewhere they just sold their 2 billionth bottle. I don't even know how many zeros are in a billion, but the point is that's a lot of tea. And I remember you said your business success was going to be the recipe you're going to take tea leaves and douse them with scalding water. And I said, wait a minute, didn't I do that just this morning in my kitchen for breakfast? And it worked for you.
Tea that tastes like tea. It's a pretty simple idea. But for some reason, everybody else who was selling tea in a bottle was putting in so much sugar that it turned into liquid candy rather than iced tea. So we brought back the basic idea of tea leaves and boiling water.
And it worked. Still working.
It worked. Yep. Sales are closing in on $500 million a year now. So people outside my immediate family are apparently buying the product.
and drinking heavily too. Yes. All right. Lesson number two, important projects are often easier than trivial ones.
Yeah. If you want to get something done, it helps to get a lot of people behind you, chipping in, contributing. And the fact is, if it doesn't really matter, then other folks, everybody's busy. Similarly, if you want your employees, your team members to really care, you want them on Friday afternoon to be saying, damn, I have to wait the whole weekend before I can get back to work on Monday. And that's not going to happen if this is a minor, small thing. And so to the extent that everything you do requires effort, one, you might as well make sure that in the end it's worth something. And two, the sense in which in academia, you write a paper that's a marginal paper, people come up with all sorts of reasons to make you make revisions. They take forever to review it because they don't really care about it. But if it's something that's super exciting, then they want to see it in print and they want to help you as opposed to frustrate you. And so we tend to think, oh, I can do this project because it's not going to take a lot of work. And the answer is everything takes work. And in some ways, the less work you think it is, the harder it's going to be to finish. And so you might as well go for the, you don't have to do world peace. I mean, let's be clear about that.
Yes.
So I don't want to say, want you to be so ambitious that it'll never happen, but I want you to be a lot more ambitious because the projects that matter in the end of the day actually are ones that are easier to make happen.
And the bigger, more ambitious projects, they attract more support, more supporters, maybe even more money, and just by thinking big. And as you say, both of them take pretty much the same amount of time or very similar amounts of time.
What you thought, you think the big project is going to be a lot harder and longer, and the small project, you just kind of make it happen. But there are bureaucratic obstacles, there's attention obstacles, and so all sorts of obstacles get in your way of these little things, and it's just at some point, it's just, you get ground down. It's just not exciting. And so it isn't worth it. And like I said, in my own academic world, if I try and publish kind of a little simple add-on paper, the referees will take months to review it. They'll come up with all sorts of picky comments because in some ways, everyone can do the little things. And so why are you going to do this rather than me? But when it's the big thing, it's like, wow, I'm excited by that. Let me join this team. Let me make sure this happens. Let me tell other people about it. No one's going to be going and sharing the excitement about this small little project you're working on. And so focus your energies on things that matter.
Okay. Lesson number three. I think this is for entrepreneurs. And this, by the way, Barry, is the only one I really want to contend with. I want to discuss with you. Lesson number three. You have to be fundamentally different and better to get noticed. Mm-hmm. This flies in the face of all my experience, but you go ahead.
Okay, well, let's hear the objection so I can...
Okay, well, not so much an objection, just a what I know, what I've read is that in marketing, perception, it's about perception, not product. There is no best product. That it's the mind matters more than the marketplace. That is in terms of getting into a person's mind, capturing mind share, again, regardless of the quality, the suitability of the product, and that people are more interested in what's new rather than what's good or better or best. And finally, that the way to get into people's minds, to get them to behave, to get them to buy things is the simple, ongoing repetition of something, anything. Could be true, could be false, just a simple, and this is known by every marketing department and authoritarian leader.
If you have gobs and gobs of money, so you can repeat your message again and again, and you can have all sorts of billboards and TV and digital media, sure, you might be able to make it happen through repetition. But what are you going to do to get people's attention when you don't have any money? Because that's the situation if you're an entrepreneur. One way to do that is to solve a fundamental problem that people really end up caring about your product because they understand why it's different and better. And it doesn't have to be on the world peace level. I mean, one of my recent discoveries is a company called Good Culture, and they have reinvented cottage cheese. Now, I basically, I had cottage cheese as a kid, and then I think it was Kraft cottage cheese or somebody. Basically, they took this product and did nothing with it. Meanwhile, if you think about how yogurt has developed over the years, now we have full fat, low fat, goat's milk yogurt, sheep's milk yogurt, Greek yogurt, Turkish yogurt. You know, you think about the number of yogurts that are out there. Cottage cheese has more protein than yogurt. Actually, I think has a better chewiness to it, fewer calories. It's a great product that's done nothing. And so I can get excited about great cottage cheese when it comes down to it. It's not just like a little bit better. It is really like, wow, this is what cottage cheese should have been. And I think people felt that way about Greek yogurt, by the way, when that happened. And so that's the sense in which if customers can't really tell the difference. Yeah, you can try and persuade them through repetition, through banners, through who knows, fancy slogans. But that's not the situation that I think most entrepreneurs are in. So economics says that you want to go and just offer a little bit lower price and everybody's going to come racing to you. I started one company that failed in New York where we were offering title insurance for people. And this is a crazy thing in the United States. When you buy a house, because title registries aren't all centralized by the government, people actually want to get insurance to make sure their title is really correct.
Mm-hmm.
And they pay $10,000 for this. It's an insane. Huh. And the total number of claims on title insurance is below 1%. So it's just a whole bogus business. And we were offering it at 25% less. And essentially, we couldn't break through. It was just not enough of a discount to get people's attention because they were buying a $500,000 house. And so kind of the $2,500 difference just didn't seem enough on the whole transaction. So you want to be in a situation where you get people's attention because they notice either the fundamental difference in price, difference in quality. And yeah, if you're Kraft, okay, you can tell me again and again, you know, about this dog food or this ketchup or something, but that's not most entrepreneurs.
On the cottage cheese, how do they improve upon cottage cheese? I can't imagine how you could improve upon tea, and you taught me how to do that. So
how could you improve on yogurt, right? Use better milk, various ways of draining it. I don't know how you make it, but whatever it is, if I gave you these two next to each other, you would know right away what the difference is. I mean, it's almost the difference between sort of American cheese and real cheese. in terms of being highly, and the other not. And you said early on, by the way, about this notion of perception. Look, I agree in the end, it's the perception is what matters. And the perception has to be that you're different. One way to get that perception is to have the reality be fundamentally different and better. So you can either and fool people into thinking it's better and different than it is, or you can try and convince them of the truth. And I'd rather spend my effort convincing them of something that's true than trying to persuade them of something that's only in their head.
Well, opinions vary about that, but it seems to me on your mortgage example that you did have a substantial reduction from the competitor, but for whatever reason, it was not perceived that way as being significant to the buyer. Because as you say, they're buying a house that's $500,000. So what's another, you know, few bucks here? But it was significant for your business model.
And in the end, what we should have done is go more to the commercial market, because when you're buying a $50 million property, now the numbers start really adding up. And so that was partly our challenge, was that even though the percentage was large, it wasn't the absolute dollars weren't enough really to get people's attention to go with an unproven company, in spite of the fact that we had Lloyd's of London being our backstop. So you needed people to actually pay attention to, one view is they shouldn't ever care about this because they're never going to make a claim. They're only getting it because the bank is making them getting it. But it's like, why should they pay attention? Their lawyer says, who are these people? We've never heard of them. You know, go with this tried and true. But if I want somebody to go and do some investigation, you know, for $15,000, they're willing to do it, not maybe for $2,000.
And so the other message is that even the smart guy from Yale had a failed business attempt. So like every other entrepreneur.
Well, let me put it this way. I was failed as on the board and an investor, but yes, I was not all my investments succeed.
Right, which is the nature of business. Lesson number
four?
Lesson number four. This is, I know you've done some negotiation work with the NBA, that's the National Basketball Association, the Professional Basketball League in the U.S., just in case there's anybody on the planet left who doesn't know what the NBA is. So you've been involved in their negotiations, and I think you said this comes from them. Point number four, if you think A is the right solution, but others prefer B, then make an impassioned, robust case for point B before you suggest that point A is the right solution?
This is a lesson I learned from David Stern, who recently passed, the former commissioner of the NBA. And we know this in law that you want to bring up the other side's arguments before they bring them up. And negotiation is often viewed as a test of wills. It's they make some argument, you have to show them why they're wrong. Well, people then keep on arguing. When they don't get their way, they think the reason they're not getting their way is because they're not being understood. And if only they could really be better understood, if you only appreciated their arguments, you would be more likely to accept their position. Now, what's the best way to convince somebody you understand their perspective? Well, if you make their arguments for them, that's a great demonstration that you understand where they're coming from and why they want B. Now, after you've done that, what happens? Well, one, they don't have anything left to say because you've already made their arguments and there's no point repeating. And secondly, they're not confused about whether or not you understand why they want B. You better, of course, have some arguments for why A is the right choice. Yeah. That's better than B. But we spend all of our time trying to knock down somebody's arguments against B. The end result is that they're convinced that we don't understand why B has some advantages to it.
So when you demonstrate that you do understand B, understand it well, that puts you in a position to refer more authoritatively to solution A. And as you say, you got to have some arguments for that to support that.
Yeah, I'm okay with the authoritative, but I want to emphasize something else, which is if you're the A supporter and I'm sorry, you're the B supporter and I've made all of your arguments for you, you have nothing left to say because there's no point repeating things. That's just taking up airtime. That doesn't help. And then the other thing is, are you still concerned that I don't understand your arguments? And I've eased that issue. So if you're not getting your way, it's not because you haven't been understood. And that's a critically important thing, that the more you argue against the other person's claims, the more they think you're not understanding them. And it's scary because you're acknowledging there's some validity to their arguments. And therefore we think, oh my God, that means I'm going to have to give them B. No, there better be just some other more powerful, more valid arguments in favor of A.
It sounds like a great way of diffusing arguments, something I learned from Herb Cohen many years ago, world famous negotiator, just draining the emotion from it. I mean, and as you're right, I mean, if you're a point B supporter, it's very hard to say, what Barry just said, yeah, that's our position. I mean, that makes it superfluous.
I'm a huge Herb Cohen fan as well. I've learned many lessons from him. We see this with kids. If you want to get a kid to leave the swimming pool and you say, come on, time to go home for dinner, the kids basically starts crying. And why is that? Well, one, they don't want to leave the pool, but two, they don't have the vocabulary to articulate why it is they think the pool is the cool place to stay. And so by helping them verbalize their arguments, you demonstrate that they're leaving the pool not because the pool isn't fun. It's because it has to be some better reason. Look, we're going to go home. By the time we get home and have dinner ready, you're really going to be hungry. And it's not just you. There are other people who are going to be hungry. And therefore, as much as I'd like to spend the rest of my life in the pool, and God knows I do, would, at some point we do have to eat and not just you. And that the inability of the other side to either verbalize or have the view that you haven't understood them is what I really am trying to emphasize here. And by the way, when you make their arguments, don't assume you've got it right. So you should always be saying, have I understood? Is that correct? Have I left anything out? Is that really what's motivating you here?
Good examples all the way. All right. Very good. Lesson number 5. Good people are led to act poorly or behave objectionably or act badly because of their poor incentives.
Mm-hmm. So I was once doing a consulting assignment for a company, and there was a salesperson who was effectively a one-man price war. And as a result, prices kept on going down in this industry, and we were trying to figure out how to end the price war. And the answer is we were the ones starting it. And why was it? Well, this gentleman was constantly getting his full bonus for hitting his sales targets. And nobody seemed to care about his profit margin. They focused on his Q, not his P. And so you could tell the person all day long not to go out there and try and steal everybody else's business. But at the end of the day, we seem to reward him for that. And so that's what he did. And one view is, well, we should fire this person. And the answer is no, we should fire ourselves because we were the ones who were rewarding him for doing the wrong thing. And when we changed the incentive contract and made it clear, the guy's behavior changed. And so he understood how he was being compensated and reacted accordingly. You'd like to think, oh, I'm going to pay you for this, but I'd really like you to do that. And it turns out that doesn't work. Then people figure out what it is that you're paying them for.
Because the guy is smart. Of course he figured it out. And of course, I've seen it replicated in so many companies.
My wife was a banker at Citibank, and they would give her a bonus based on the fee she would earn on the first year of her contracts when she signed up another bank. And these would tend to be 3 and 5 year contracts. Of course, when you bring in the new customer in, what they fundamentally cared about was getting a great deal in year one so they could look good. So we had this whole problem because from her perspective, she only cared about year one fee. From the banks, the customers thing, they, in some sense, wanted the first year fee to be low. She wanted it to be high. And nobody seemed to care about years 2 through 5. And so at one point, we talked to the senior managers. It was like, well, why isn't the bonus based on the lifetime value of the contract, not just the first year fee? Answer is, well, what happens if the person leaves? And the answer is, we'll send you a forwarding address to send the checks. So, it doesn't, that we appreciate that the money has to come in years 2 through 5. But when it does, you can pay a bonus based on that. And so you've created this incentive scheme whereby you've made it harder for us to make the customer happy and to bring the new customer on board.
I think you're illustrated too. I mean, people are not dummies. They see which behavior is being rewarded. They can figure it out, and that's how they act. No longer listening to what the bosses say. I can see who gets rewarded and for what actions.
So there are just, if you look around, it's not hard to find cases where incentives are misaligned. And when you find them, just fix the incentives and behavior will follow rather than try and change the behavior directly.
Pretty simple, isn't it? Fix the incentives, the behavior will follow.
But it's not so simple because people don't see those cases. I'll give you one that's, I think, very well hidden. In the United States, people are really trying to get a tax on gasoline for carbon. And folks have talked about a 50 cents a gallon tax, $1, $2. No one even thinks a $3 tax is at all feasible politically. If you look at the way auto insurance is sold, auto insurance is sold on an all-you-can-drive basis. By that, I mean you pay the same amount for auto insurance if you drive 10,000 miles or 100,000 miles a year, which is insanity. It's like saying, I'm going to charge you the same amount for gasoline if you drive 10,000 or 100,000 miles a year. No, you pay 10 times as much for gas. Mm-hmm. And the average person who drives 12,000 miles a year pays roughly $1,200 for gas and $1,200 for insurance. And so insurance is about the same price as gasoline. What that means is if you had to pay for insurance on a per mile basis, which is the smart way of doing it, it would effectively double the price of gasoline. So it would be like the equivalent of another $3 a gallon tax. So we are subsidizing people to drive more by saying, we're not going to charge you an extra $3 for 25 miles of driving, which is what we should be doing. And as a result, people drive too much.
So you're more of a user pay system. The more you drive, the more you pay.
Correct. And the answer is obvious. You just have to say, wait a second, how come we're not doing that here?
Well, the answer, I suppose, it would be the entrenched interests that have financial incentives to keep it the way it is.
Well, so I served on the board of a Fortune 100 insurance company for a dozen years. And I was pushing them the entire time to do this. One challenge is that men drive twice as much as women and pay the same amount for auto insurance. If you're going to go to a pay-per-mile basis, you're going to have to raise your rates on half your customers and lower your rates on the other half. Well, those people you raise your rates on might leave you and take with them their homeowner insurance, their life insurance, and other products. And so that's a challenge. But what's happened since then is companies like Metromile have come in and are offering pay-per-mile insurance. And so all the people who are low-mileage drivers are moving over to them. And what does that do? That leaves you stuck with the really high-mileage people who are being subsidized. And so eventually that system collapses because the people ultimately have to keep on raising their price and then they're going to leave. But it takes a while. And so that's why it's hard for the incumbents to change.
So it's not as easy and straightforward as it appears. But the point is, align your incentives with the behaviors that you want repeated.
Yep.
Lesson number 6. This is for every manager out there. I want you to hear this. In fact, write it down. For each action you take, think of 3 perspectives. First, what is the effect it will have on the current situation? 2, what is the effect it will have on the precedent 3, what is the effect it will have on my relationship with others?
Well, I'll give you an example of where I got this wrong and got myself in trouble. I served on a board where we had great trips to Hawaii and Paris and all sorts of things where we would meet the top salespeople. And the management of the company gave us, the board members, the same kind of, I don't know, I won't call them tchotchkes because they were more than that, rewards, presents that they were giving their top salespeople. Things like Apple watches, funky, fancy sunglasses, and so on. And I pointed out, you know, it's one thing for us to be there because we want to congratulate and reward the salespeople, but we hadn't done the sales. We weren't entitled to these presents, these bonuses. Management wasn't giving it to themselves. They were just giving it to the top performers. So why were we getting this? And on the scale of things, you know, I don't know, maybe it was $1,000. So it wasn't like a huge amount of money, but I thought we were in the process of cost tightening and it was just sending the wrong signal. And some of the management folks, they said, you know, thank you for saying that because some of our staff, you know, they feel a little jealous about this. They don't think it's really right, but they didn't want to upset the board. So it has to come from the board. And so I proposed this and it passed unanimously because how could anybody possibly object to this? You can't really say, yeah, we should be getting these things that we don't deserve. And then it turns out many of my board members' spouses were all upset because they liked those things because their spouses were just too damn cheap to get it for them. And so I really pissed off a lot of my colleagues in this process and hurt my relationships. The question was it worth doing or not? And it was a small battle. In the end of the day, it didn't really make a lot of difference in terms of the money. So I don't know. I mean, my view in life is I really care about making the right decision and I care less about the effect it has on other people and my relationships and the precedent. I care about that, but I suspect I would have been more effective in the long run if I cared about those things more as well.
Possibly. But I mean, I think it says more about the board members and their spouses than it does anything else. I mean, let's not overlook that fact, but humans are humans.
I get it, but I had to work with them, right? They're there. Going anywhere and they're going to be for the next 10 years. And so, okay, some of them were small-minded and cheap. I got it. Now the question is, what do I do about that?
Well, take it into consideration and modify your behavior accordingly or not. I mean, that's what it comes down to, I suppose.
I mean, they're getting, you know, $300,000 a year for being a board member. And they're whining about losing $1,000 in little presents. Anyway, so I tried to set the right example, but I said it definitely hurt my interpersonal relations. And, you know, you spend a lot of time having dinner with your other board members and often their spouses on these trips.
Well, I'm a little surprised by that. I can understand it being a kerfuffle, if that's the word I'm searching for, but for it to linger and carry on and be extended past, you know, 8-12 minutes, I mean.
Well, that's what I'm dealing with, my friend. So here's the thing, Jeff. Had you been on the board with me, you would have made the same decision, and I wouldn't have had that problem with you.
Yeah, easily.
But for the other folks, some of them, that was not who they were.
You're saying that recently in Australia, a woman who headed Australia Post, she gave her senior executive some Cartier watches valued at, I think 20,000 each and a bunch of them, let's say 200 grand. And the press found out about it, went crazy. The government found out about it, went crazy. She said, wait a second. These people just won a $26 million contract that will keep this company, Australia Post, afloat.
Yeah. You
know? And by the way, it's all according to board guidelines. Bottom line is she ended up leaving the company after much embarrassing. She now has another job. But, the people who look bad are the government and the press for getting it so wrong. I mean, somebody brings some of the bacon for $26 million to a struggling enterprise. She gives them Cartier watch. Where are you going to wear a Cartier watch? I don't go to that many balls, but.
I think that was her mistake. It was the wrong watch. They should
should have been a Casio, like mine or something. Yeah, but I mean,
give them a smart car or something. Give them a Tesla. But the point is, there are these small-minded folks out there. In this case, it was the press.
Yeah,
and it turned out that she made the right decision. I thought I made the right decision, but it ended up backfiring because of the cost it had on relationships. And so you have to think about what are you going to when. When small-minded people protect their own interests, you know, this was a case. Remember, one of our earlier points is you should focus on the big things rather than the little things. There were big issues that I cared about, too. If I'm going to piss somebody off, I might as well piss them off on the big things. Not the little ones.
Yeah, so spend your political capital wisely, I suppose, is my take on that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that takes us to the point number 7. It isn't enough to be right. You must persuade others that you are right.
Yeah. And this is something that's, I'd say, the biggest difference between a professor and being in the real world. Because in academia, the best thing that ever happens is you go out there with your theory, your research, and everyone says, oh, that's completely BS. It'll never work. And then 10 years later, people discover you were right. You win your Nobel Prize, you get your tenure, whatever it is. And it's like, wow, look how smart, original that person must be, because no one thought it could ever work. In the real world, if you're proven right 10 years later, that doesn't help, because it's sort of, you haven't launched, you haven't made it happen. And so there's a distinction between having the right idea and convincing others now, not in 10 years. It doesn't help to say, yeah, you know that idea about that iced tea thing that people said wouldn't work? Look, 10 years later, somebody else did it. I was right. You have to go and get people to be believers. The I told you so gets you a huge amount of points in academia, not in the world.
Well, I always say, in terms of sales, marketing, any relationship, it's all about, can you convince and persuade the other person? Can you convince and persuade me to buy your product or whatever? You know, you're married. You know what it's like. You got a partner. You got to convince and persuade all the time. And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. And sometimes it's okay, maybe even good if you can't, because that's the way it goes. But you sure don't win them all, that's for sure. Lesson number 8, be prepared for people to screw up. And my corollary to that is, and they will not disappoint you.
Yeah. So there's a line from Shakespeare, many a slip betwixt cup and lip. And in general, people say to me all the time, you know, oh, you're micromanaging, you're sort of worried about all the things that can go wrong. But the answer is, the amount of stupidity that's out there never fails to surprise me. So my favorite examples of this, I'll give you 2. We went to one store at Honest Tea, where they weren't putting Honest Tea in the cooler right next to the salad bar. And we said to the manager there, look, here's some data showing RT outsells the product you have there 2-1 in your store. So can you please put our product in the cooler here? I know that. We used to have the tea there. The problem is it sold out so quickly that the shelves were empty by lunchtime, and then we got complaints. So I put this new thing in there. It doesn't sell, and now it's not a problem. It's like, okay, I want to shoot him at this point. And say, well, what about just restocking? He said, well, if I restock, then it's not cold. And I said, well, what about taking cases, putting them in the cooler in your back? So when you restock with chilled product. He said, well, I'm not allowed to do that because your product's shelf stable and we have to reserve the refrigerated area only for products that need to be refrigerated. Okay, so let me get this right. So basically your solution is to put stuff in that doesn't need to be restocked, because that's how you're going to make customers happy, by giving them stuff they don't want.
No, it's how he's going to make his job easier with fewer hassles.
So in the end, what our solution was is we bought the guy a bigger fridge. So because ultimately his problem was our problem. But nonetheless, it's like, you know, yeah, guess what? If you don't open up the store until 5 p.m, you don't have to worry about restocking for lunch. Another case is we had a distributor who told us he wouldn't carry our product because he wasn't making $5 a case. And I'm thinking, that doesn't make any sense. Snapple, you know, what do you make with Snapple? He says, I make $7.20 with Snapple. And I'm thinking, wait a second, you know, you're making what, $4.50 with us. How can you make so much more with Snapple since our product sells for more? And then I realized Snapple comes in 24 bottle cases. We come in 12 bottle cases. So in a 24 bottle equivalent, he'd be making $9 with us versus $7.20 with Snapple.
Darn that arithmetic.
And I point that out. And I said, look, you know, you're comparing a 24 bottle case to a 12 bottle case, you know? And I said, look, if we took 2 of our cases and wrapped them together with tape, would that work for you? He said, yeah, that'd work. Then I'd make $9 a case. I said, could you just wrap them in your mind, please?
You know, what I love about this is that it's so real, so true, so accurate. And I think anybody in business has had similar experiences when.
And we just, in another company I'm in, we just got kicked out of a large supermarket chain because they didn't think our unit volume was high enough. And yet we were killing it on dollar volume. Why? Because we were $9.99 for 5 pouches. And we're going up against other people who are selling single cups for $2.79. So our unit volume could be half of theirs. And our sales could be 3 times theirs. And it's like, what, do you care about units or do you care about dollars? It's like, yeah, well, I'm being measured on the unit velocity. And so this is going back to that old notion. If you give people the wrong incentives, they do the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. In my case, we ended up being screwed by it. And because of the pandemic, we didn't have the chance to make our case in person, but it's just insanity. So in the end, by the way, we had to move to start selling single pouches. And so, because that way we had many more units, but we're measured on stuff that makes no sense.
The thing that I see here, and I've been in management consulting for decades now, is so many companies don't actually understand their own business. And as you say, they're measuring the wrong things, incentive for the wrong things. And it's not, I forget who said it, but the whole idea is to create a customer and keep a customer. You do that and you're pretty much on the right track.
Yeah, and they come up with silly rules like I'm going to mark everything up 30% and not make a distinction between a product that's a premium product or a generic product. And so if you're selling Honest Tea at $2 and Snapple at $1, do you actually need to make 60 cents in every bottle of Snapple versus 30 cents on a, sorry, 60 cents on a bottle of Honest Tea versus 30 cents on a bottle of Snapple? At the end of the day, the customer is going to be buying one bottle. And so I don't claim that profits have to be the same on each. So you might say, I want to make 40 cents on Honest Tea and 30 cents on Snapple, but I don't know why it should be double. And they basically say, well, you know, I have to have my analysts are just looking at my profit margin. But ultimately, it's profits, not profit margin, that matter. And you want the customer to buy the $2 thing so you could make 40 cents rather than the $1 one so you can make 30. And they're actually discouraging customers from buying the products where they make more money. And so instead of thinking about what our profit margin should be on each product, they just say for this whole category, we're going to impose a 30% or 40% or whatever markup rule they're using. And that just penalizes anybody who has a premium product. And so it pushes everybody towards the low end, which is not great. And this is true even at Amazon, where you'd think that they have, you know, literally thousands of people who are plenty smart and super data focused to get this right, but they don't.
I think what you're also illustrating is the resistance that people have when the explanation is proffered to them. And I really like the lateral thinking you did by buying the guy a new refrigerator, a new cooler, because I mean, that just it's a win-win situation. That's thinking laterally, thinking outside the normal constraints.
You're assuming they're thinking, but that's the problem. They don't get to think. That what companies do is they create rules so they can be run by idiots, because eventually they will be. That was the Peter Lynch line. You want to invest in a company that can be run by an idiot, because eventually it will be. And the problem is the company doesn't want folks thinking. And so either they don't think or they're not allowed to. And that's the challenge. And it goes back to our earlier line about incentives, that this guy being incentivized to move unit volume. Or another case in the company I was involved with, basically, we were making products at below efficient scale because we were new. And so what that meant is we would do a larger production run than made sense, so we therefore have more inventory. But the person who's in charge of inventories basically was killing us, saying, oh, all my metrics are looking terrible. Because in this matrix organization, he didn't care about what our cost of production was. He only cared about what his inventory turns were. So everybody looks at their one piece of the picture and not the big piece, not the full piece.
Well, and that, of course, is that's where the general manager, the managing director, the senior execs, that's what they're supposed to be doing, yes?
Assuming it ever gets to them.
All right. We'll move on to lesson number 9, which is feel free to bend the rules. For example, if somebody asks you for a list of 10 life lessons, you can bet that they'll be pretty happy with 9. Hey, wait a minute. You're talking to me?
I'm afraid I am. One of the things that's true in life is that the rules are things, you know, I'm not talking about antitrust laws or laws of physics. I don't want to repeal gravity. But in negotiations and most things, the rules are what you agree they are. And so feel free to talk about them right at the beginning. I say in negotiation, let's talk about how we're going to negotiate. What's our ground rules for negotiation? Don't jump in to talk about price. Don't jump in to talk about reasons. Let's talk about how it is we're going to negotiate. And in general, people, I think, are a little quick to accept the rules.
And you're pointing out that there is flexibility. There is latitude, whether you see it or not, whether you acknowledge it, it's there. It's there. It's just, say, why not explore it? You're not the only one. Of course, William Murray, very other famous negotiators point that out.
So there you go. Your 9 lessons for today. That's
What about, let me leave one final question. What have you unlearned lately? something you absolutely knew to be positively true then, a while ago, could be years ago, could be yesterday. But now you know it's not the case at all.
I'm not sure what it is that one of my mottos in life is often wrong, never in doubt. Yeah. And so I think I've been wrong about so many things that it'd be hard for me to figure out which one it is that I have unlearned. So I would say the recent case of looking at whether or not the COVID-19 came from a Wuhan lab or not, I would say I pretty early on dismissed that along for some reasons, and it probably isn't true, but I guess I'd say I may have dismissed that a little quicker at the time than I should have.
I'm with you. I mean, I've been wrong about so many things. My new motto in life, and has been for the last few years, is don't be so sure. That's what I tell myself all the time, man.
Well, I'm going to try and flip that on you. It's fine to be sure, as long as you realize that you're often wrong.
Let's just say I have a steady stream of disconfirming evidence coming at me all the bloody time. You know, so and that's all right too. That's the other thing. I quite accept this happily. You know, if I'm wrong, I'm happy. You know, just let me know so we can get on with it.
In fact, one of the things I did, and you can give a link to in this piece in the New York Times, where is really a test to look for disconfirming evidence. That people are always trying to find evidence that supports their hypothesis, and that what a good scientist does, and I think actually a good entrepreneur does, is look for evidence that proves themselves wrong rather than proves themselves right.
That's what Don Pepper says. He quotes a story about Warren Buffett. I don't know if it's true, but it's worth repeating. He says when Warren Buffett wants to make an investment, he hires a team of advisors to tell him why he should, and then he hires a team of advisors to tell him why he should not. And then he listens.
It's the red team and the blue team. Mm-hmm. And Israel does that with its intelligence. And the Pope does this when you elevate somebody to sainthood. It's the advocatus diaboli. And so I think we need a lot more of the devil's advocate out there. The idea that you can be arguing against something, even if you believe in it, because we want to make sure both sides of the arguments have been heard.
And we'll close on that note. Folks, you've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for career and life. Our guest today has been Barry Nelba from the Yale School of Management. This episode is produced by Robert Hosry and is sponsored, as always, by Professional Development Forum, which offers insights, media, discussions, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need. And it's all free online. You can find it at professionaldevelopmentforum.org. If you've heard from us, we'd like to hear from you. Email us. It's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. While you're at it, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, because remember, this is the podcast, the only podcast that makes the world wiser lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening.